Europe remains in the grip of the worst cost of living crisis of the past 50 years, with staggering inflation and looming energy bills eroding wages for people across the continent. Over the past year, food and rental prices have gone up through the roof, while thousands of people are losing their job as a result of the energy crisis. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at European countries like the UK and France and see how their economies are suffering and whether there are any solutions on the horizon for Europe or not. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the Spotlight. Limpet Opec, former British Member of Parliament, joins us from London. Also joining us is Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst, also joining us from London. Gentlemen, welcome. Limpet Opec, first over to you. So I'm sure you saw, or maybe you were part of it, I don't know, but 500,000 people there in the London went on a strike. It's the largest strike in 12 years. We understand British teachers, civil servants, train drivers, university lecturers were part of that. What did you think about the strikes when you saw it in those numbers? Because that's rather large.
Well, it's affected me. The reason I'm sitting here in a coat outside is because I can't get where I want to go. The train drivers are also on strike. What we're seeing here is a general strike over a period of months. This isn't just one organized group of people who are saying that they're not happy with the current situation in the United Kingdom. It's actually millions of people who are not happy about that. We're basically observing a situation where the government has lost control of its relationship with the public. Any government has to rule with the consent of the public, and they are not having that at the moment, and that's the problem.
Well, Clive Menzies, the government says, according to the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, that the pay rises need to be, quote, reasonable and affordable. And he went on to warn that big pay rises would jeopardize attempts to tame inflation. Do you agree with Prime Minister Rishi Sunak? And if not, what are your views on what is happening there in the UK when it comes to strikes?
Well, good evening. And I think this conversation has to be seen in the context of previous conversations, because this is a structural war that has been unfolding over the last 20 years. And more particularly, it's accelerated in the last 3 years. If we think back 3 years, people were applauding the NHS and clapping for the NHS in the midst of a mythical pandemic. And that was the structural collapse of the economy. Basically, they closed down, they sabotaged huge swathes of the economy. Meanwhile, we've had this massive increase in money supply, which is driving inflation through the roof. And this is deliberate sabotage. The UK government, Rishi Sunak, is, as we had a conversation, I think, in September, when I talked about Liz Truss. These are people who are, if you like, pigeons carrying the blame for what has been teed up over the preceding years. And so the government has no real power in this. They're basically trying to catch up with events that are unfolding, but they were predictable. We were predicting this in 2015. Interestingly, I was at a conference last night on emerging risks in the city of London amongst financial people, and they too have very little idea of the sources of what's coming down the track as we speak. And part of the agenda is to create chaos and division, that people will blame each other for what's going on. But what is emerging amongst a growing number of people is a realization that we are in a war, and this is the war of the structure against ordinary people, people mm-hmm. like myself and others like me. And they are beginning to fight back in the form of not paying utility bills, not paying council tax, and basically developing their own networks for food supply, working with local farmers, looking at localized health solutions that are not reliant on the NHS. And basically what's in emerging is a very nascent but an alternative to what state and the structure cannot provide.
All right, a last question on the UK before we move on to other countries. Limpet Opec, so our guest there raises a good point, I think, where he says that people are devising their own methods of how to tackle this. For example, not paying their utility bills. We know there was a movement of that recently. Also, the question, the bigger picture, I think, the question to you would be, at what point will the Sunak government realize that, hey, these strikes, not only are they growing in frequency, but the numbers are now beginning to swell to the point that it may bring the city down to a standstill? and therefore something needs to be done. I repeat what he has said, and I'm wondering what you think of it, where he has asked people who want pay rises to be reasonable and affordable, and that big pay rises would jeopardize attempts to tame inflation.
Well, I'm sitting here on a bench in the middle of London because I cannot get home because of the strikes. The specific answer to your question is they already know this. They recognize that they have lost control, and I agree with my colleague that there is a structural disconnect at the moment between government and the public. Fundamentally, what's going on here is the public and the organized unions don't any longer really have faith in governmental influence. Let's remember, we've actually got a former chancellor, who's only a chancellor briefly, who's responsible for £4.7 million of tax that he hadn't paid. When you've got that going on in government, then it's very difficult for the public to trust what's going on in Westminster.
On to France, Clive Menzies. France is into the conversation of this program because of the sheer numbers of people that took to the streets, anywhere from 1.27, some say, million people, or French, and some say up to 2 million. And this is over this pension reforms. Pension reforms has been always a controversial and a sticking point for any government in France. The plans to raise it to the age of 64. What are we looking at when we're looking at France, Clive Menzies, and the way that the cost of living crisis in this particular point, pension reform plans are going down?
Well, I think it's important to differentiate between institutions and people. But we, like the French, like the Germans, like the Dutch, and like all the other European nations, have been under siege. And I think the French recognize this. If we go back to 2018 and the Gilets Jaunes process, it was very much structural assault on their way of life. And this has been going on for at least a couple of decades, if not much longer. And basically, people are getting to the point where they realize that there is no salvation within their government. I mean, Macron has been, I referred to the Gilets Jaunes protests and what provoked them as the pressure cooker being fired up. And this has been done progressively across Europe. And, you know, we're not just talking about France. We're talking about the attacks on Dutch farmers, the attacks on German living standards. I mean, Germans are basically being deindustrialized. There is a wholesale onslaught of both structural and kinetic violence that people are beginning to awake to. And not only that, they're beginning to awaken to the causes thereof. Nobody can be blind to the amount of greed and corruption that has been prevalent across all society, across all government institutions and related institutions. And people are noticing, and they're beginning to ask themselves, why are they reliant on these structures? And the only recourse out of this is to actually develop an alternative system. It was Buckminster Minister Fuller, who is probably not someone familiar to many, but he wrote a book called Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth. And one of the things that he famously said was, you don't fix something by trying to tinker with it from within. You create something new that will make it obsolete. And that's what's mm-hmm. beginning to happen. And that can only be a good thing. The unfortunate thing is that because of the structure in its death throes is becoming ever more desperate, things are going to get a lot worse before they get better. But certainly within my local area, there are people developing alternative systems to live with, which make them less reliant. And that is a global phenomenon, not just peculiar to North London. It's going on across England and it's going on across the world. There are self-organizing societies in France, in Spain, in Mexico, right, among others. And I'm sure there are many more.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
There are other countries, and we could talk about each country, since there are quite a few of them in the European Union, Limpid OPEC. What is that going to do if I just throw you an inflation figure, for example, and that they're not obviously they're experiencing cost of living crisis? One of the things not talked about Limpid OPEC, and I'd like to find out what you can tell us, if you can, is a thing called greedflation, greed with a D, corporate profits soaring. The sectors that it seems like that's happening in are, you're looking at energy, you're looking at things like the food, from what I'm understanding, the technology sector and luxury sectors, where they're enjoying an unprecedented amount of cash bonanza, if you want to call it. This is on the backs of people, so they're taking advantage of what's happening. Of course, the one that really stands out is in the energy sector. Isn't there anything that's being done there in the UK to start off with, and other places? I mean, I'm looking at, for example, how these energy firms have made combined total profit of 75.9 billion euros over the first 9 months of 2022.
First of all, something can be done. I know nothing serious is being done. Let me explain that. And let's just take the energy sector example as a case in point. The reason that the energy sector is making so much money is the idiotic and stupid policies in the West when it comes to energy. You can't run a modern economy with solar panels and turbines. I know we're not discussing claims about climate crisis right now, but however you power society, that's not the way you can do it. And Germany, which has had a very green, and you mentioned Germany, it's got very green credentials, it claims, it's going back to coal. So what we're seeing here is an ideology virtue signaling causing a massive increase in the cost of energy. The second and perhaps even more important point here is politicians are very bad at making technological decisions, and there are no sensible decisions being made at the moment. If you want a clean grid, you need to go for nuclear and potentially tidal as well if you've got water. You don't do it by simply waving a flag in the sky. The sun will always shine even at night. So if you add all that together, the West has now got an energy crisis, and then of course it depended on its arch enemy Russia to get cheap gas. That's a recipe for it's a perfect storm, and you can't have it both ways. You don't declare war on your best energy friend and pretend that you can't get a bad result from that.
Please tell us what you think about the energy factor, Gladman Zias, when it affects obviously all countries, and this is something that has inflation as a consequence when we take a look at the energy. I guess I can call it a crisis because we're still looking at it. Explain to us what is going on there. There's some coverage on that where it says Europe is not doing that badly. They were able to meet their energy needs. But many, I think, don't realize that they're going through the reserves, and that problem still exists.
Well, I think Lembit's exactly right. There is an ideological problem that underpins this, and that's the phony climate crisis, which has created this environment of what's called ESG, environment and social and governance, which basically all businesses have to comply with or they'll go out of business, according to Mark Carney, who's the UN's climate envoy. But let's think about what we're talking about. We're talking about energy and food. Energy is what's built our civilization and allows us to live what is, in relative terms, a very sophisticated or fairly sophisticated lifestyle. Food is essential for life, come what may. And undoubtedly, there has been a lot of price gouging going on. If you look at, I drive a petrol-driven car and I drive past the pumps on a regular basis and see the prices fluctuating. But actually, they bear no relationship to the underlying oil price, which actually is back where it started before the so-called invasion. Another major factor is the sanctions that are basically self-imposed flagellation by Europe in participating in these sanctions on Russia, as Lembit alluded to. You know, there are plenty of customers for Russian oil and Russian gas and Russian food, and those customers are in India, in China and elsewhere. And if Europe really wants to turn itself into an impoverished backward society, they seem to be going about it in exactly the right way. Undoubtedly, the oil companies and food distribution companies, not only are there attacks on food distribution, but they're profiteering as well. But the only solution is to get back to as close as to where you can access your own food. For example, energy is a bit more of a problem.
Sure.
But we ought to at least call out the lies that are surrounding the war in Ukraine that's been going on since 2014. It didn't start last year. It started by NATO in 2014.
So let's look at some of the figures, Lembit Opec. You're looking at inflation, 11.5% across the European Union. That's a breaking point. Wages, well, the average annual energy bill, it's a month's wage for low-paid workers in the majority of the EU member states. Food banks shot up in the past months. Italy, as an example, 85,000 people. Low-paid workers is another concern, where they are hit hardest by this crisis. I'm forging all these stats into one, because as you said, they're aware of this. The governments are aware of this. So where is that threshold? When is it going to be a breaking point where they feel threatened, where people power is going to overtake the streets, is going to overtake institutions, and there's going to be pushback? Because, yeah, we're looking at Europe, some of these protests, I mean, like the ones in France, it's almost like a party sometimes. But then again, it's not. Some of the scenes you see, the police obviously taking matters in their own hand to control some of the violence. But when is that threshold going to break? When is that line going to be crossed?
Yeah. On the first point, what we are now seeing is companies who are profiteering. You're right. And I agree very much with my colleague this evening that that they are making exceptional profits, but that's their job. They're not charities. They want to make a lot of money, and they've got the opportunity to do it. In terms of the breaking points question, it's not a number, it's a state of mind. The issue here is that the public, all around me, not just me, many other people can't get home tonight. They'll have to spend a fortune, maybe on taxis. There comes a point where, and it won't be far away, where people say, this is enough now. We are going to take this into our own hands. So you get away from political power to people power. There's a group I met yesterday called Together. And they are basically saying, we don't care what party you're in, Mr. or Mrs. MP. We care about the fact that we pay you to do a job for us and you're not doing it. How long till people have had enough? I would say 4 to 6 months, certainly before the next general election. I would say for the next election, there will be a big change. And political parties be less important than how people feel about individual politicians. I'll give you one example. They want to diesel vehicles in Britain. I don't think they can do it. Once the public realizes that's going to happen and essentially takes their choice of mobility away, the public will say, if you don't let me drive my car, I won't let you get reelected.
Okay. Final question. Clive Menzies, I'm not sure what word to use, but it appears that the EU is moving down a path that is being somewhat, many say, dictated by the US when it comes to Russia, for example. And if we're going to see any change there, which we then can conclude, okay, sigh of relief, things are going to maybe go back to normal, the US has China on its mind, which means that things are not going to get back to normal. Are we looking at the US, the core of some of these problems that exist in terms of it wanting to defeat Russia or weaken Russia, and therefore the EU is being led down that path?
Well, our analysis over the last dozen or so years reveals that actually although America seems to be all-powerful, America is not in control. Money power controls everything. Central banks around the world collude to manage economics, and money power through foundations and various levers of power exert their will, whether it be through congressmen who are bought off or members of parliament. So everybody is enthralled to money, and that is what is running things. And what goes on in terms of geopolitics is very much money playing both sides. And obviously, different countries wander off the reservation, as it were, from time to time. So Hitler wandered off the reservation in the 1930s, and that's why World War II started, although it was a deliberate means to take it down. And the same with Russia and China. These are geopolitical games. These are not accidental. They are contrived. And people are awakening to the fact that their politicians are powerless in this respect.
Thank you. We're going to unfortunately have to end it there. We have to let Lempidopic get back to his home, hopefully. Lempidopic, thank you very much. Former British Member of Parliament from London. Thank you. And also from London, Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst there from London also. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tafai and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, determination. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of determination in the Islamic lifestyle. In the Islamic teachings, Allah has emphasized on the determination and having the firm determination to follow the right path. We must have this intention every day and in every single movement if we want to perform the self-building, if we want to have self-building. And the self-building cannot be achieved if we do not have a firm determination of following the right path. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in chapter Hamd to guide us to the right path, to take us to the right path. And therefore, in our routine life, we must strive for this determination. Now, determination, as we said, it is meant that we leave all the sins, we avoid all kinds of evil and sins. And on the other hand, we perform the wajibat or the obligatory things. We must perform the things that we missed. We must redo them. There are many times that we forget to, or maybe we miss our daily prayers. I must redo that during my life and should not leave it for others. I missed my maybe fasting, or maybe I'm traveling in the month of Ramadan and therefore I miss some of the fasts. In the normal days, I must redo that. I should show that I am determined to perform the orders of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I am the pure obedient of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this is what we need to do, this determination we need in order to have the pure Islamic lifestyle, in order to have a lifestyle that takes me to the perfection. I must have a pure determination, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of determination in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that it is necessary that we have the firm determination in order to have the pure Islamic lifestyle. Now, the minimum thing that we can have as a Muslim in order to have an Islamic lifestyle is that to have an Islamic appearance. An intellectual person, he have the appearance of the intellectuals. He have the appearance of the one who follows the Sharia. Therefore, the minimum thing, the determination that I can have in my life in order to have the Islamic lifestyle is to change my appearance according to what Allah says, according to what Islam says. For example, if I am a Muslim man, I must have a beard. I must avoid talking to the non-mahram, to the strangers. I must avoid the parties or the gatherings where there is haram. I must be good with my parents, with my children, with my wife, with the neighborhood, with the people where I work. I must be a kind person in the society. On the other hand, for our sisters, the general appearance, the basic appearance is to have hijab, observe hijab in any condition that you are. There is no exception. You must observe the hijab. You must not socialize with non-mahram. You should adorn yourself for your husbands if you're married. And if not, then obviously you should remain at home. When you adorn yourself, it should be for maharim and not non-mahram, the strangers. It should be for the ones that are mahram to you. And there are many other things. The general appearance, the apparent appearance says that we must pray 5-time prayers. We must fast in the month of Ramadan. We should not break our fast. We should not break the rules and laws of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the society if I want to have the pure Islamic lifestyle. Inshallah, may Allah give us the pure determination to have the pure Islamic lifestyles in our daily life, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The situation for refugees in and around the European Union is getting worse by the day. At a meeting of EU lawmakers in Brussels on Wednesday, it was announced tougher controls will be used on the border between EU member Bulgaria and non-member Turkey.
Like drones and radar and other means of surveillance. As we've done last year, for example, in the last years, for example, in Romania, we've done it in Spain and Greece and in Poland.
EU institutions and leaders are accused of breaking international law surrounding the protection of refugees.
What is the EU answer to these protection gaps? More walls, more drones, more returns, more funding to Libyan detention centres.
Campaigners say shunned refugees are fleeing countries destabilised by the West. At the same time, millions of Ukrainians are being welcomed here and given the same rights as EU citizens.
This is a clear, hypocritic, racist, organised policy that the EU practising. And this is not a new thing. This is an historical discrimination that the EU stands for as an imperialist power in the world.
Legislators are calling on EU leaders to provide safe, legal routes for refugees.
We need to guarantee the right to asylum for those who need shelter so they are not shamefully piled up in refugee camps or illegally pushed back or drowned in the Mediterranean Sea.
The EU is currently developing a new asylum policy, but it's already shrouded in scepticism.
The Commission has to step up to break the cycle of mistrust existing between member states by enforcing also current rules.
Many EU nations are now struggling to accommodate the millions of Ukrainian refugees who have travelled here. Thousands more continue to arrive each year. Agencies across the EU that are already overwhelmed warn breaking point is being reached. They are demanding additional resources from governments. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
The 44th anniversary of the late Imam Khomeini's return to Iran from several years of exile, marking the beginning of 10 days of celebrations. In Iran, festivities have begun, with Iranians from all walks of life gathering in the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini to renew their pledge of allegiance to the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, while a special ceremony is also underway, demonstrating that the divide-and-rule policy of the enemies of the Islamic Revolution has failed.
I've come here to renew my pledge of allegiance with Imam Khomeini, who was an advocate of social justice and at the forefront of fighting oppressors worldwide.
Assyrians have been living in Iran for more than 3,000 years. This shows that no matter what our enemies do, we will remain united as a nation.
Over the past 44 years, we have managed to overcome many obstacles simply because we remain united, and it's important for our nation to remain that way.
A point that was also raised by the keynote speaker of the ceremony, Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf.
The Islamic Revolution is known worldwide with the name of Imam Khomeini, a great man known for fighting imperialism who always invited the nation to be united in the face of our enemies' plots and said, you know, you're walking down the right path when your enemies do everything they can to stop you. If your enemies are ever indifferent, it is a clear sign that we have deviated from the right path. So their increased animosity is actually a good sign.
That is why the presence of masses at the mausoleum this year is more significant than previous years, considering a period of foreign-backed riots in the country and Western countries increasing political pressure on Iran to unprecedented levels.
We are here to say that we are proud of our revolution and our country.
When Imam Khomeini needed our support to topple the Pahlavi regime, my sons did not hesitate.
I am here to say that I will always support the leader and the Islamic revolution.
My son gave his life for this revolution, and I am here to uphold his values.
Iranians are celebrating the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution at a time when they've managed to thwart foreign-backed riots in the country and bring peace and calm back to all the cities across Iran. More than anything, the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution is a show of solidarity. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The decision to send German and American tanks to Ukraine is continuing to generate controversy. Many believe the move will prolong the war, and there's concern as to how Russia might respond. However, at a parliamentary hearing on Tuesday, EU legislators were told the West should go even further.
Russia is attacking Ukraine
from Russian territory. So obviously we should provide the Ukrainians with long-range missiles, obviously.
There are a lot of EU lawmakers who agree.
Any delay to supply Ukraine with needed weaponry and ammunition is more lives lost on the battlefield.
Some argue constantly supplying lethal weapons to Ukraine is foolish.
We're prepared to risk nuclear war in order to continue this US-NATO proxy war. It is total madness. And this European Union and the European Parliament have lost the plot. They've lost the run of themselves.
European Union taxpayers have provided 50 billion euro to Kiev since last March.
What happens to all the money we send to Ukraine? Is it just disappearing into individuals' pockets? Even President Zelensky has had to admit there's a big problem with widespread corruption.
A number of legislators would like to see less division within the EU.
Austria and Hungary just decided we will not deliver weapons. Okay, it's their decision. But that shows already some hesitation or some breakup of unity.
Spanish MEP Javier Nart told his colleagues it's, quote, ridiculous to suggest Ukraine can win the war against Russia. For now, the US and Germany have ruled out providing fighter jets to Ukraine. Others, including France, have not. According to many analysts, the risk that the conflict could escalate further and spiral completely out of control has never been greater. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin visited South Korea this week to reassure officials here that Washington will remain committed to the U.S.-South Korea alliance.
The U.S. commitment to the defense of Korea is ironclad. You heard us say that a number of times, but that's just not a slogan. It is what we're all about. That commitment is ironclad. And our extended deterrence is at the heart of that commitment.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol restarted large-scale joint military exercises with the U.S. last year, although the U.S. reportedly deployed its so-called strategic assets, weapons capable of delivering nuclear bombs. The South Korean leader wants more American firepower at his disposal. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has repeatedly suggested the need for the U.S. to make a stronger demonstration of extended deterrence, its nuclear umbrella. And the South Korean public has grown skeptical of the U.S. alliance, with a majority now advocating that South Korea develop its own nuclear weapons. The U.S. has also pressured South Korea for greater cooperation with Japan in participation in joint drills. Peace advocates find such a trilateral alliance worrisome.
If the South Korea-U.S. and South Korea-U.S.-Japan alliances are established through cooperative military exercises, the South Korean military will now defend Japan and the U.S. mainland in the Pacific, not South Korea. South Korea will then be reduced to an outpost to protect the United States and Japan.
Meanwhile, earlier this week, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg visited South Korea to encourage Seoul to send weapons directly to Ukraine. South Korea is exporting weapons to countries that are sending their own military supplies to Ukraine, but has so far refused to provide Kiev with direct military aid. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In a new decree by the Ministry of Higher Education, the Taliban government ordered universities and private institutions in Afghanistan not to enroll women in the entrance exam of 2023. While this decree strengthens a December decree that totally banned women from education, women feel frustrated about their future educations.
When I first heard that we can't enroll for the entrance exam and saw the decree, I felt frustrated. I had high hopes for my future. I feel terrible about that.
I felt like my life had come to an end when I heard this. To be alive is not just to breathe. One must reach their dreams. I felt deeply sorry and not alive.
While the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, with 57 members of Muslim countries, has called the new decree disappointing, Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, in a press conference expressed his country's readiness to provide any kind of support to Afghanistan in order to restore women's education in the country. Iranian universities had already announced their readiness to hold online classes for the women of Afghanistan. The women in Afghanistan say such a cooperation could be useful.
Once again, we stress that banning girls and women of Afghanistan from education is an improper act and against Islamic teachings. Iran is ready to offer any kind of support needed to upgrade education and reopen schools for the women of Afghanistan, in coordination with the interim Afghan government.
Meantime, Afghan women say international community has turned a blind eye to their problems.
Unfortunately, whatever happens in Afghanistan, the international community just condemns it. Online education, on the other hand, is definitely positive, but not as much as face-to-face classes. We women ask the international community to negotiate with the Taliban on reopening the schools.
Education ban in Afghanistan started 500 days ago on girls in 7th to 12th grade, then a ban on universities 2 months ago, and following that, women were banned from working for foreign NGOs and organizations that caused many of these NGOs to stop their mission in Afghanistan. Now, a ban on entrance exam and the question, is there going to be more such restrictions? In both decrees on women's education ban, a line draws attention saying, until further notice. But nobody really knows if and when this ban will end. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
Nadeem Zahawi, the Conservative Party chairman, fallen from grace for not paying his taxes. He received accolades as vaccine minister during the pandemic and even ran for prime minister last year. His downfall began after it emerged he settled nearly a $6 million dispute with the UK's tax collector, HMRC, during his time as chancellor last summer. An inquiry ordered by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak found Zahawi had breached the ministerial code.
Zahawi is out, but now the focus has shifted to the Prime Minister himself. This week, he'll be facing tough questions in the building behind me about how much he knew about Mr. Zahawi's tax affairs and when.
Zahawi's sacking has also acted as a reminder about Rishi Sunak's reinstatement of Suhaila Braverman as Home Secretary last year, after she resigned for breaching the ministerial code by sending a sensitive official document from her personal email account.
Sunak has said he wanted to have a government of integrity, essentially, and it sends the wrong signals in that sense too. We therefore see a government which is drifting and failing to achieve some of its own specific targets. And that's got to be a worry for the Prime Minister and indeed for their election chances.
Speaking of Boris Johnson, he's been named by his supporters as a potential candidate to replace Nadeem Zahawi.
He's seen as a vote magnet, but he's also a trouble magnet. Most recently, we've seen these questions being asked about the chair of the BBC helping him out with a loan. Nothing has been said about law-breaking, but with all of the other problems the Conservatives have, do they really want to risk Boris Johnson in a position where he could bring more intrigue, let's say?
That, in addition to a parliamentary inquiry into whether Boris Johnson misled the House of Commons over Partygate, lockdown rule-breaking drinking sessions during the pandemic, and an investigation into numerous complaints of bullying by Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab. Nadeem Zahawi will be remembered as the minister who played fast and loose with the rules and became the first one to be dismissed by the prime minister. But no one's sure if he will be the last. Saeed Purizep, London.
Tensions between Muslims and Hindus in Britain have risen following the recent release of a new BBC documentary, which explores the rise in Hindu extremist politics in India and concerns that India's Prime Minister may be facilitating the increased violence against India's religious minorities. Over the weekend, British Hindu protesters condemned the BBC with a series of demonstrations outside their UK offices. In one case, a British Muslim of Kashmiri descent confronted a group of Modi supporters in Birmingham.
Modi is a terrorist! Modi, that's it! Keep it
Some clashes turned violent, as was seen in Australia, this time between Modi supporters and local Sikhs. The two-part documentary, India, The Modi Question, has not been broadcast in India by the BBC. Despite this, India's federal government banned the film, citing emergency powers under India's controversial information technology laws. An attempt by Indian students to air the programme on Friday in New Delhi led to scuffles and arrests.
Where is our freedom to express? Here we students are not supposed to watch a documentary. If it is hidden, if it is banned, then sure there might be something important in it.
Here in Britain, local activists have expressed concern over the possible spread of the same Hindu supremacist ideology to UK shores.
It's a double standard. When they cry for help, they're seen as the victim. But when we cry for help, we're seen as the aggressors. And the simple fact of the matter is that the extremist Hindu community here in Birmingham, it has been growing, has been growing for some years.
In 2022, two English Midland cities witnessed street clashes between Hindus and Muslims, with locals complaining that the troubles in India had essentially spread via the Indian diaspora to British shores. This new documentary has clearly opened old wounds, which could be traced back to 2002, during the notorious Gujarat pogroms, which left approximately 1,000 Muslims killed. Robert Carter, London.
Pakistan's northwestern city of Peshawar was gripped by fear and chaos after a bomb ripped through a mosque situated close to the police headquarters. The injured were taken to the nearby hospitals by rescue workers. Crowds were seen hurrying to the blast site and hospitals in search of their loved ones.
We were assembled in the mosque for the evening prayers. I was among those who were ready to offer prayers. All of a sudden, a massive explosion occurred and the roof of the mosque collapsed suddenly.
After this attack, the government of Pakistan has vowed to fight back against terrorists until the last drop of their blood.
We will not spare those who want to sabotage the peace of the country. We will chase after them. All political stakeholders should sit together to maintain peace in the country.
Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan initially claimed responsibility for the attack. However, later they distanced themselves from the bombing, saying it was not their policy to target mosques, seminaries, and religious places. Experts say the Pakistani government needs to take up the issue of growing terrorism with neighboring Afghanistan. The Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan militants are said to be hiding in Afghanistan while carrying out attacks inside Pakistan once in a while.
This is really a source of great worry for Pakistan and the security forces of Pakistan. Pakistan was expecting that after the Taliban takeover in Kabul, the terrorism will go down and this tide of terrorism will subside. But that has not happened, unfortunately. The Taliban tried to broker a peace deal with between the government of Pakistan and TTP. Parleys were held, talks were held behind the scene between the security forces of Pakistan and the TTP leadership, but that didn't work.
The country's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif has appealed to the people for blood donations for the injured in a terrorist attack in Peshawar on Monday.
Pakistan is facing a resurgence of violent attacks in recent months. Analysts believe that government has to deal decisively with Taliban militants to maintain peace and economic stability of the country. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
The first international conference on media and the unity of the Islamic Ummah kicked off in the capital Tehran on Sunday to discuss ways for the unity of the Islamic Ummah based on media activities. Media activists, managers and journalists from different Islamic countries attended the first Minaret International Conference held by Iran's World Forum for Proximity of Islamic Schools of Thought. The unity of the Islamic Ummah, media truth and media literacy, and the capacity of international media were the three major axes which were discussed by the participants at the first Minaret International Conference in Tehran.
I have taken part in the first conference on media and Islamic unity because I believe the media play a key role in shedding light on the atrocities of the oppressive regimes like Israel against Palestinians. Islamic media can keep the path of resistance alive and inform more people of what is happening against Palestinians in the occupied lands.
Moreover, the participants in the event, in a statement, condemned the recent insults to the Holy Quran and Islamic sanctities in European countries.
In today's world, media outlets play an important role in creating a campaign against a nation, religion, or belief. Western media centers have become the centers for waging war against other countries. The recent sacrilegious moves in European countries against the Holy Quran originates from the same policy. The insulting move hurt the feelings of billions of Muslims and provoked hatred and discord.
The statement also condemned Western governments for planting the seeds of hatred and animosity and fanning the flames of violence in the world. It underscored that Muslims based on their religious beliefs never allow themselves to insult the sanctities of other faiths and that the followers of Islam hold all divine books and prophets in high respect.
The first international conference on media and the unity of the Islamic world is aimed at building capacity, network, and raising awareness among Islamic nations with regard to international development, especially anti-Islam currents, which will further forge unity among Muslims worldwide. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Limelight.
In Britain, the National Farmers Union has called the British government's environmental targets as irrational and unachievable. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The National Farmers Union raised questions about the government's proposed targets on water pollution, tree planting and rewilding, calling them irrational and unachievable, according to documents published by the Environment Department. Under the 2021 Environment Act, the government was required to set legally binding targets for nature recovery and environmental improvements. It began consultation on those targets in March of 2022, recommending, for example, an increase in tree canopy and woodland cover from 14.5% to 17.5% of total land area in England by 2050. Water pollution reduction targets were initially set for 2037. After the consultation closed and the targets were published, there was some disappointment. The tree canopy target had been reduced to 16.5%, while the water pollution target had been delayed to 2038. The newly published consultation documents showed that the National Farmers Union's response was highly critical of the initial proposals. The lobby group, which represents powerful voices in the agriculture sector in Britain, said proposals to reduce nutrient pollution from animal waste and fertilizer were irrational. It told the government, broadly, we consider the level of ambition across the nutrient targets to be unachievable, inconsistent, and irrational. The National Farmers Union and its members are committed to building on past successes and further reducing nutrient losses to the environment from agriculture. However, this effort must be balanced with the need to produce food, fibre and energy on farm, thereby protecting the rural economy and maintaining food security. The union also said it did not agree with targets to reverse species extinction, and in particular spoke out about reintroducing lost species. It said, the National Farmers Union has long advocated that we should support species that are already present before we seek to introduce new species. So instead, we believe that we should aim to prevent the loss of species. As such, a bespoke target approach to rare and threatened species could be beneficial in driving action to reduce biodiversity loss. It argued that the concept of rewilding was damaging to the countryside, warning against adopting an approach that risks undermining the social fabric of rural communities. It said, "Rewilding, for example, ignores the fact that our iconic farmed landscapes are valued by the many who make 4 billion visits to the British countryside each year." It also said the tree planting target of 17.5% coverage was too ambitious. An increase in tree canopy and woodland cover from 14.5% to 17.5% equates to 415,000 hectares of tree cover by 2050, approximately 15,000 hectares of trees a year. This is extremely ambitious and it is unachievable. Nature groups said the union was deluded and dangerous, and that it was stunting progress towards a greener future after its lobbying against nature restoration policies was revealed. Rob Percival, the head of the food policy at the Soil Association, said, "The National Farmers Union's attitude towards environmental targets is defeatist, deluded and dangerous. There is clear scientific rationale for regenerating woodlands and increasing tree cover, but the National Farmers Union thinks it's too difficult. Our rivers are choking on excess nutrients, primarily due to the proliferation of intensive livestock systems. But the National Farmers Union has dismissed pollution reduction targets as irrational. Instead, they propose more of the same, more poultry, more pollution. It's a bizarre and unfortunate that the National Farmers Union is displaying such a lack of imagination when the stakes are so high. Resolving the climate and nature crises will entail difficult trade-offs in land use and a radical shift in the way that we eat and farm. With the right policies in place, farmers and producers can be paid to lead the change. In adopting such an obstructionist stance, the National Farmers Union is letting down its members, failing the public, and stunting progress towards a greener future." A DEFRA spokesperson said, "We have full confidence in our Environment Act targets, which were established through intensive consultation with businesses, land managers and environmental organisations. The delivery of these targets will require a shared endeavour across the whole of the government, business and the individual decisions we all make. And through the Environment Act, we have ensured a robust legal framework to hold current and future governments to account, protecting nature for generations to come." The Director of Policy at National Farmers Union, Dr. Andrew Clark, said, "British farmers share the government's environmental ambitions, but these targets must work in tandem with producing quality, sustainable food. The government's own land use strategy seems to conflict with its ambitions for nature, as well as delivering on its self-sufficiency targets, as set out in the National Food Strategy." Farming Forum website has also covered the story. The National Farmers Union raised questions about the government's proposed water pollution, tree planting and rewilding targets, calling them irrational and unachievable, according to documents published by the Environment Department. The lobby group, which represents powerful voices in the agriculture sector in Britain, raised questions over proposed legally binding Environment Act targets, which were subsequently weakened by the government. Farmers are to receive additional payments of up to £1,000 a year for protecting nature and the environment as the government changes post-Brexit subsidies to agriculture. The increased payments will come under the Environmental Land Management Schemes, or ELMS, the cornerstone of the government's system for replacing the European Union's much-criticised Common Agricultural Policy, or CAP. But farming leaders said the sums were small relative to farmers' needs and left many details of the payments still uncertain. The National Farmers Union said the announcements risk being too little too late. The Farming Minister, Mark Spencer, announced the new payments at the Oxford Farming Conference, a major event in Britain's farming calendar. Ministers have been under pressure for months over ELMS, the environmental land management schemes, as successive prime ministers last year gave conflicting signals over the future of the system. Farming Minister